All I can say in by way of introduction to this week's shiur is that while we've all been celebrating Hanukkah, the brothers have been going through quite an ordeal. It just occurred to me on Shabbos, and we take for granted we have all the information at our disposal. There was a time when everything people knew about the Chumash they found out in shul in weekly installments. And for the poor person who this was his first time round, he's in a week of great suspense as events end in the way that they do in Parshas Vayigash, where the worst of all possible scenarios materializes in front of the brothers. And Binyamin is found with the cup. They're all sent home. Binyamin is to be kept with Yosef. And Vayigash begins with Yehuda making his final impassioned plea towards Yosef. And if we have a look at the opening pasuk, Vayigash Elav Yehuda, Vayomer Bi'Adoni, he's careful, he's cautious, but he's also determined. Yedaber na abdecha davar ba'aznei Adoni. Let your servant, that is to say me, let me speak a word in your ear, literally, davar ba'aznei Adoni. And this is an expression that we find once in a while in the Torah, that a person speaks ba'aznei someone else. And we always need to ponder what is the specific connotation of this word. Presumably, when you speak, someone listens. What is the specific meaning of davar ba'aznei someone else? And there are Meforshim, and in fact there is a source for this in the Medrash itself, that what Yehuda means with the words davar ba'aznei Adoni is that he wishes to speak to Yosef directly. As we know, so far there's been a go-between, and Yehuda wishes to remove that person and address Yosef directly. And as we can appreciate, difficult to understand what Yehuda hopes to achieve by speaking to Yosef directly. As far as the brothers is concerned, this Egyptian viceroy does not speak their language. They're quite sure about that. In fact, in last week's parsha, in Miketz, we see that they speak freely amongst themselves. Even in Yosef's presence, it's clear to them that he doesn't understand their language. They talk about the recriminations and comeuppance with regards to the sale of Yosef. They're standing right in front of Yosef and saying, we didn't have Rachmanis on him, we should have had mercy on him. And they, as far as they're concerned, he has no idea what they're saying. Well, if that's the case, so then what? It's a waste of time to speak to him directly. I mean, what can Yehuda possibly hope to achieve? As Yehuda recaps, the events, Pasuk Yutes, Adoni Sha'al Savadav Lemor, Hayesh Lechem Avaach, you ask, do we have a brother? Do we have a father? Do we have a brother? And this is how Yehuda recalls their response. Vanomer El Adoni, and we said, Ishlan Avzaken, we have an elderly father, V'yelet Zekunim Katam, and a younger brother, V'achiv Meis, and another brother who's dead. So Binyamin is really the only one left because his brother is dead. Now the truth of the matter is, as Rashi points out, that was not what they originally said. If we go back to last week's parsha, to Miketz, they said that we have a father and there's a brother, Binyamin, and Vayichad Einenu, one of them is missing. And therefore, whereas in reality they said that the other brother is missing, here Yehuda says that they said that the brother was dead. And Rashi comments on this. Rashi says, Mipnei Hayira, because Yehuda was afraid, rightly so, at this stage, Hayamosi Dvar Sheker Mipiv, he said something that wasn't actually true. He changed the story. Amar, for he said, that is to say, Yehuda reasoned, Imo Milo Shu Kayam, if I say he's alive somewhere, Yomar Havi'uhu Etzli. He'll tell us to bring him also. We'll never get out of it. We told him about Binyamin. We had to bring Binyamin. We tell him the other brother's alive. We'll have to bring him also. And therefore, the better option is just to say that he's dead, and then you can't bring him. Now, no doubt, Mefarshei Rashi discussed this comment of Rashi at length, but if we may ask perhaps one or two basic questions. Yehuda has changed the story in order to go for a safer option. He's afraid. If he says Yosef is alive, then this person will demand that he be brought to him. The question is, how does he see changing his story to be the better option? Presumably, that is instantly worse. As if to say, if we assume that this Egyptian leader remembers what they said, and presumably he does because he's taken a special interest in them, as soon as you say that the brother is dead, he will say, well, why are you saying that? The first time you said that he was missing, and now you say that he's dead, perhaps something else is going on. In other words, the potential danger of him saying, bring him to me if he's alive, seems to be relatively remote. How can they be reasonably expected to bring him there? If he's missing, they can't find him. But on the other hand, what Yehuda does in order to avoid that problem seems to put him into a greater problem, because he has instantly changed the story, and that is definite danger. And that, I think, is the basic question that needs to be raised here in terms of how Yehuda thought it was better to change the story. And perhaps we may answer both of these questions, why he gets rid of the interpreter and why he changes the story, by making reference to a very interesting comment that is made, as quoted in the name of Rabbi Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz, who we know, of course, as the author of Lecha Dodi. He wrote many other works, Perush on Megillas Esther, Perush on Megillas Rus. And this is quoted by one of his, it must be a near contemporary of his, Rabbi Shmuel Laniado. Rabbi Shmuel Laniado lived in Sfat in the 1500s, and he is the author of a number of works, and he's actually known as the Baal HaKelim, because they all start with Kli something. He is the author of the Kli Yochar on Nevi'im. That is to say, there's a well-known parish Kli Yochar on the Torah, Rav Shlomo Lunshitz of Prague, not related, but the Kli Yochar on Nevi'im is from Rabbi Shmuel Laniado. And he has a Sefer on Torah, which is called Kli Chemda. Again, there's a later work called Kli Chemda from the 1900s, but the original, or the earlier Kli Chemda, is again Rabbi Shmuel Laniado. It took me a long time to track this Sefer down, but this is before anyone suggested to, or on the online possibilities were available. But I finally found a library with the Sefer Kli Chemda of Rabbeinu Shmuel Laniado, because I know that he discussed this. And in the beginning of Vayigas, he says, Shamati b'shem Maharash HaLevi Alkabetz. I heard in the name of Rabbi Shlomo Alkabetz, they lived in Tzfat, that actually, at this stage, Yehuda begins to suspect that it really is Yosef. In other words, what's changed in these moments is not just that he feels he needs to be more proactive or take a different approach. He already finally begins to think that it's Yosef. And if we ask the question, well, why does he think that? The more pertinent question is, why did no one think this until this point? Because only so much has to happen before someone has to start thinking, maybe the answer to all of this, that it's Yosef. Yosef went missing, here's this person, perhaps it's Yosef. Why did they not think this way beforehand? As we see from the Psukim, the brothers practically ignore Yosef. That is to say, they ignore the person in front of them as his own concern. They see all of this as divine retribution for what happened with the sale of Yosef, which means Lev Melachim Biyad Hashem. This person, whatever he's doing, it's Hashem's way of punishing them for what happened with Yosef, and that's why they never really see too closely the person behind this ordeal, because as far as they're concerned, he's irrelevant practically. However, at the end of last week's parsha, when Binyamin has come down, and Yosef wants to keep Binyamin and send them all home, at this stage, it doesn't make any sense, even not in terms of Yosef, not in terms of divine retribution. After all, if it's all about divine retribution, how come the only one being kept behind is the only one who was not involved in the sale? And moreover, there are things about Yosef himself which do not seem to make any sense, even on his own terms. There's a fascinating medrash quoted by Rabbi Shulam Diskin, where Yehuda approaches and says, "Binimusim shelanu," in our law, in Jewish law, the halacha states that a person can be sold if he stole, but only if he doesn't have the wherewithal to pay. Im ein lo, vinimkar b'gnevaso. If he doesn't have the wherewithal to pay, so he sold into servitude. Aval ze yeshlo, but Binyamin, he has assets, he has the means with which to pay. So why are you keeping as a servant? So Maral Diskin asks the Shaila, I mean, what exactly does Yehuda expect from this Egyptian leader? I mean, listen, it's true, it's a pasuk in Mishpatim, although Mishpatim has yet to be written, but the brothers know the halacha, that may well be. But all of a sudden, the ruler of Egypt, you have a taina against it, but he's not paskening based on the Gemara, but Metzia, that Ein lo v'nikar b'gnevaso, I mean, that's hardly a claim. You've got your rules, we've got our rules, he broke both of them anyway, so if you don't mind, leave the Gemara aside and let Egypt discuss the matter the way Egypt rules. So what does Yehuda meaningfully mean by saying, Benimusim shalanu? You know, by us, we don't paskin that way, so please explain. What's to explain? But Maral Diskin says that what Yehuda was emphasizing here is that there's something counterintuitive about keeping Binyamin. The truth is that Bichlal, it's an interesting shaila. If a person stole, so then in order to pay, he gets sold as a servant. Who's going to take him? As if to say, the only thing we have on his resume so far is that he's a thief. Who's going to volunteer to bring such a person into their house? I mean, you're basically asking for trouble, which is a good shaila. But the answer is that he's only ever sold im ein lo. In other words, it will only ever come to a situation where he's sold into someone's household if he has nothing. I mean, he stole because he has nothing. You catch him, he can't even repay. He doesn't have any money. A person without money is liable to steal. But if you take him in, and you take care of him, and you give him a good environment, and you rehabilitate him, it's an amazing situation, but it's only considered to be a credible venture if the reason why he's told is because he has nothing. He doesn't want to steal per se, but he was desperate. You can help him. But that's exactly why the halacha says if he has what to pay, no one should buy him, because if he has what to pay and he stole anyway, it means he likes stealing. He doesn't need anything. He likes to steal. You're not expected to take a person like that into your house. And that's really what Yehuda is saying. You don't have to paskan like our halachas, he says to this Egyptian leader. And interestingly, he doesn't call it our religion or our law. He says, benimusin shelanu. Benimus means there's something about the way we deal with these situations that should make eminent sense to anyone. Namely, you only take a thief as a slave if he doesn't have what to pay with. Because if he does, you're asking for trouble. Today he stole the cup, tomorrow he'll steal the candelabra, and then on Tuesday he'll steal your chariot. But still Yosef insisted on taking him. But why? It already does not make any sense. Moreover, says Rabbi Shurley Diskin, there's a great deal of care that we need in looking at the final psukim of Miketz, because when the brothers are caught, they say that whoever is the cup is found with him, he should be put to death, and we'll all be your servants, we'll all be your slaves. When it comes to it, Binyamin is found, and Yosef says you can go free. So the question is, what did the brothers mean by volunteering all to be servants? After all, what do they have to do with anything? The one who's stole the cup, he's the one who's guilty. Why would they pronounce this chumrah sentence on themselves. We'll all be your servants. Clearly the brothers want to stay with Binyamin, but what's behind volunteering? But the point is, what they're saying is, as is often the case, the person in whose bag you find the cup does not mean that he was the only one who was involved in the theft. After all, you suspect us of the worst, and we're a team, and there's 11 of us. The one who found the cup might be just the one who looks most innocent, the one who we thought you would never look in their bag because you seem to like him so much. But it could have been any of us, and perhaps could have been all of us, aiding and abetting the theft. There's only one cup, but sometimes more than one person is involved in the theft. And therefore, we're so convinced that it's not there, that if it is, you're entitled to take all of us as somehow complicit or involved. Well, if they're basically admitting to that, and the cup is found with Binyamin, so what does it mean to let them go? As if to say they're practically admitted to being involved. If Yosef is so set on laying down the full weight of the law, so why would he let them go? For this reason and more, the brothers begin, and Yehuda specifically, begins to reassess the entire situation. And strange as it sounds, and as inconceivable as it sounds, perhaps the thought begins to rise in his mind that the answer to all of this is that it's actually Yosef. The problem is, how are you going to find out? If you approach him and ask him if he's Yosef, so then that's not going to get you very far. And if you say that he's Yosef, you're going to get yourself into more trouble just in case he isn't. Yehuda doesn't know. So what is the only way that he can find out? And based on this idea of Rabbi Shlomo Alkabetz, perhaps we can understand Yehuda's strategy here. It's a very interesting situation. Our question was, why are you approaching Yosef and talking directly to him? It's a waste of time. You know that he doesn't speak your language. There's been an interpreter to date. Yes, that's true. However, reasons Yehuda, this time last week or a month ago, it would never have occurred to us that he actually does speak our language. But if it's really Yosef, then for sure he does. Now, he will not admit to it. But if I speak to him enough, all that Yehuda needs to do is to get through to him. He just needs to retell the story, which is legitimate itself. He's only defending himself, but he's talking directly to Yosef. The amazing thing about the situation is that what's happening now is that Yehuda is retelling the story, and Yosef, for his part, has to make like he doesn't know what Yehuda's talking about, because officially he doesn't speak Hebrew. And if the worst comes to worst and he doesn't speak, so Yehuda wasted another 2 minutes. That's the least of their worries. But if he can only, and he retells it, and he emphasizes so much the pain of their father and how difficult it was to let Binyamin, he's just looking to crack this person in front of him. He's just looking to get some type of reaction, a glimmer of recognition and of essentially concession that it's really Yosef. That's what he's looking to do. And if that's true, then perhaps we may say there is no greater way to get a reaction from a person that you're talking to than to tell them that they're dead. As if to say, Yosef knows the story and he knows what to expect, and Yehuda's waiting for the point and he's getting him into it, and you asked us and we said we have a brother, and Yosef officially doesn't really understand what he's saying, and then he says, and his brother's dead, and Yehuda looks at that point, because if someone tells you that you're dead, whereas in fact rumors of your death have been greatly exaggerated, then you will react, you can't help it, and that's really what Yehuda is looking for, a reaction to Yosef. And the truth of the matter is, by the time he's finished, Yosef can't take it. By the time he's done, Yosef cannot listen to everything Yehuda is saying and pretend not to understand a word. And Yehuda's theory actually was verified, it really was Yosef, and then everything crashes, everything breaks. And everything changes, and he says that he is, in fact, Yosef. So that, I believe, is a very thought-provoking approach with its many attendant points to the events at the beginning of Parshas Vayigash. Now, I'd like to move from here to a matter which, as we'll see, it seems to be somewhat of a minor point within the parsha, but it has major implications for us on a halacha lemaisa level. And let's take a look at Pasuk Kaf Gimel. Perek Mem Hei, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. So Yosef is sending provisions to their father back in the Eretz Canaan. Ula Aviv Shalach Kazos. And what does he send to Yaakov? Asara Chamorim. 10 donkeys laden down with Nosim to Mitzrayim, all good things from Mitzrayim. Vesarasonos and also she donkeys, Nosos. And what are they carrying? Bar Valechem Umazon La Aviv La Darech. Now, bar valechem means grain and bread. And what's mazon? Three terms here. Bar, lechem, umazon. Bar we've had a few times, but is the grain itself. Lechem is bread, as we know. And what about mazon? So there is a Medrash Rabbah on the Pasuk, which says that mazon is chalutin. That's the term that it uses. Chalutin. And what is chalutin? Chalutin is food, perhaps cooked food, but it's not grain. I mean, the bar and lechem is the grain and the bread. So chalutin is other foods. Fine. And that's the translation of mazon. And then the Medrash adds the following enigmatic comment. Rabbi Yochanan, when he would eat chalutin, he would say, I haven't eaten any mazon today. That's the follow-up comment. So again, to summarize, what is mazon? The Torah's word mazon is chalutin, those other foods. And then it says, but when Rabbi Yochanan would eat chalutin, he says, I didn't eat any mazon. Okay. Sounds like Rabbi Yochanan disputes the previous parallel, the previous translation. The first opinion says that mazon is chalutin. He would eat chalutin and says, I didn't eat mazon. So mazon is not chalutin. Okay. Otherwise known as a machlokas. And we've had a few. But it is a rather unusual way to express the machlokas, as if to say, if you think that mazon is not chalutin, so why not just... Why tell us a story about what Rabbi Yochanan would say when he ate chalutin? Why not just tell him what his opinion is about what mazon is? If it's not that, if it's not chalutin, let it be something else. It certainly seems to be an unusual way to present a machlokas. Okay. So what are we to make of this medrash? Let's move to the halachos, to the siddur, actually. As we know, on every Yom Tov, we describe the Yom Tov, we'll call whatever it is, Chag HaShavuot and Chag HaSukkos. When it comes to Shmini Atzeres, the formula is, V'atiteinon HaShem Elokeinu Moadim L'Simcha, Hagan Zasasan, Es Yom Shmini Chag HaAtzeres HaZeh. Or some say, Es Yom Chag Shmini Atzeres HaZeh. Okay, but the point is, Shmini Atzeres, okay, and we call it a Chag. Shmini Chag HaAtzeres HaZeh. Now that may sound quite straightforward. We're quite liberal with the way that we use the word chag, and we'll certainly say chag sameach. And however, the Taz, the Turei Zav, in his commentary to the relevant section of Arachaim, Tafri Samach Tes, I think it is, says, you know, if you look through the whole Torah, you'll never see that Shmini Atzeres is actually called a chag. It's called Shmini Atzeres, but it's not called a chag. So why are we calling it a chag? And moreover, says the Taz, the matter is underscored. Because the Yerushalmi in Maseches Nedarim states explicitly that as far as the Torah is concerned, Shmini Atzeres is not considered chag. People call it a chag, but the Torah never calls it a chag. How does it come out? What if a person took a vow, Nedarim, took a vow, that he will avoid something for all of chag? So now you've got to know when Chag is. And the Yerushalmi makes a point of saying that whereas the Torah calls Shmini Atzeres Chag, but the Torah doesn't call Shmini Atzeres Chag, but people do. And you know how Nedarim goes. In Nedarim, you follow the way the people talk, which means that even though from a Torah's point of view, it's not really a Chag, but people call it a Chag, he would need to avoid that food or whatever it is also on Shmini Atzeres. He said Chag, and people call Shmini Atzeres Chag. Fine. But says the Taz, but you see clearly that the Torah doesn't consider it a Chag. So how do we refer to it that way in our tefillos? Says the Netziv in his Perush Hamik She'ela, which is his commentary on the Shi'iltas of Rabbi Chaigon in Shi'ilta Ches. The Netziv says everything that the Taz quoted is correct, and that is the answer to his question. In other words, what did the Taz note? The Torah doesn't refer to Shmini Atzeres as Chag. People do. And he had a question. Why then does the Siddur? The answer is, says the Netziv, because the Nusach of Tfilah is based on how people speak, not on how the Torah speaks. In other words, the very Yerushalmi that the Taz quoted as an objection is actually the solution. People do call it Chag, as we see for Nedarim. And that's why the Siddur calls it Chag, because the Siddur HaTfilah is based on the way people speak. And perhaps one may say, if it's not too much of a presumption, by explanation of the matter, that Tfilah is really people expressing their wants and their needs. And therefore, it's reasonable that they should do so in the way that people speak, and people call it a Chag. So the Siddur calls it a Chag. And the truth is, says the Netziv, here it's expansive. We call something a Chag, which the Torah never called a Chag. But it can also work the other way round. The Shulchan Aruch discusses a question. What if a person on Yom Tov, and of course, what's the nusach for the concluding bracha, middle bracha of Yom Tov? Baruch Atah Hashem, Mekadesh Yisrael Bahazmanim. Okay. What if a person mistakenly concluded the bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem, Mekadesh HaShabbos? And it's Yom Tov, it's in the middle of the week, it's not Shabbos. And the Shulchan Aruch rules, if you on Yom Tov said Mekadesh HaShabbos, you've got to go back. That's incorrect. That is an inaccurate way of referring to Yom Tov. Shabbos and Yom Tov are two different things. It's unfortunate, but it's wrong. But the Machon Avraham raises a question. We know that Yom Tov is also considered Shabbos by the Torah. It's clear from the Gemara. When the Torah says, Ach es Shabsosai Tishmoru, in the plural, it refers not only to Shabbos, but also to Yom Tov. That's how Rashi explains the Gemara. Now, if that's true, so then he didn't say it in the best way possible. The best is Mekadesh Yisrael Vazmanim. But he didn't say something wrong. It's not wrong to say Mekadesh HaShabbos. The Torah calls Yom Tov Shabbos, and he called Yom Tov Shabbos. So he's saying like the Torah. Why is that considered a mistake? Says the Netziv, for exactly the same reason. In other words, once we establish that the Torah follows the way people speak and not the way the Torah speaks, that means that if the Torah may call something by a certain name, but people don't, it's considered to be a mistake. And you'd go back. That's the full extent of this idea. And therefore, people don't call Yom Tov Shabbos. If a person would say Good Shabbos on Yom Tov, he would immediately correct himself. He wouldn't say Good Shabbos and see Rashi and Erevin and Daf Tzadik Vav. He'll even as a save, he wouldn't do that. It's a mistake. I mean, no one calls it Shabbos. And because no one calls it Shabbos, the Siddur doesn't countenance it as acceptable. It's considered a mistake, and you've got to go back. Wow. The truth is, one could say that the roots of this idea, although it's not exactly the same, but the roots of this idea may be found in a tshuva of the Rashba. Someone asked the Rashba an interesting question. This is in Chelek Aleph Simin Kuf Nun Zayin. And the question is on the nusach of the bracha over lulav. As we know, what's the bracha? Asher kedushanu mitzvot tzivanu anatilas lulav. And so the questioner asked, I'm not sure who the questioner is, But the questioner asked, you know, the Torah doesn't use the term netila. We know what the Torah says. The Torah says, ulekachtem lachem. Ulekachtem lachem, b'yom harishon. And because since the verb that the Torah uses is ulekachtem, so shouldn't the bracha more accurately be al lekichas lulav? And that's how the Torah said it. Interesting shaila. What does the Rashba respond? A very brief response. Zo eino she'ela. That is no question. Why not? She'ein makpidin belashon. Because we're not so particular with the terminology. Kol she'anu shomim ha'inyon. As long as the point comes across clearly. We see that the way brachos and tfilos work is that we're not particular to talk about things in the, necessarily in the way that the Torah does. The Torah says lekicha, and we say al netilas lulav. The meaning is clear; it's perfectly acceptable. And in fact, says the Rashba, she'im kein, because if we were particular, sha'al, you should ask lama anu omrim al netilas lulav. You should ask, why do we talk about netilas lulav? Ve'ein anu omrim al netilas kapos tmarim. The Torah never uses the term lulav. We call it a lulav. The Torah calls it kapos tmarim, as we know. And similarly, v'chein b'tfilin. Make two brachas, one or two brachas, on the tfilin, laniach tfilin, amin sastilin. The Torah never calls it tfilin. The Torah calls it a few other things. La'os ha'yadcha, zikaron. The Torah calls it totafos. Say laniach totafos. Rather, you see, b'chol ha'mitzvos, with all of these things, ein ha'kpada rakal shmiras ha'inyan. The point is just that the idea comes across. Lo baloshim, we're not that particular with the expression. Now, on the one hand, this tshuva of the Rashba, it supports what the Netziv is saying, that we're not so reliant we do not adhere exclusively to the expression of the Torah, but the truth is that I think the Netziv says more, because the Rashba says we're not makbid to keep the lashon of the Torah. According to the Netziv, we're actually makbid to keep the lashon of people if it's not like the Torah. And even if you said like the Torah, it would be considered a mistake, like we saw with the Mekadesh HaShabbos. But in any case, we do see that this is the understanding of how tefillos work and how brachos work. And says the Netziv, this is the explanation of the Medrash that we quoted just a few moments ago about the meaning of the word mazon. Let's remind ourselves. On the one hand, what is mazon? It's not bread, it's not grain. Those are other terms, bar and lechem in the pasuk. So what's this third term, mazon? Well, the Medrash says it's chalutin. And then Rabbi Yochanan, he would eat chalutin, he says, I didn't eat any mazon. Is he disputing that the definition? Says the Netziv, no. He's not. It's not a machlokas. He's not coming to dispute the definition. But what he means to say is, whereas the definition of what the Torah uses when it uses the word mazon is chalutin, but people no longer talk about mazon like that. And it makes a difference because there is a bracha, for example, bere mine mazonos. And the question is, well, on what type of food should you make a mazonos? Surely, if you could only find the food that the Torah calls mazon, that sounds like mazonos, so you should make a mazonos on it, and you don't. And the reason why is because people no longer call that type of food mazonos. They only refer to the five grains as mazonos. And that's what Rabbi Yochanan is looking to emphasize, as if to say, I concur with what my colleague said, that when the Torah uses the word mazon, it refers to chalutin. But I'm telling you, if I would eat chalutin, I would say I haven't eaten mazon, because that's the way people talk, and you should know it. It has a halachic import for the way that brachos and tefillos go. So this is a very interesting, again, we've only just really mentioned one or two of the highlights of this idea, but the principle is fascinating, and certainly what goes behind it, that when it comes to tefillos and brachos, we follow loshem b'nei adam. Not only even Lashon B'nei Adam, only Lashon B'nei Adam, as the Netziv demonstrated. Well, as Yosef and the brothers are reunited Yosef tells them that they should all come down to live in Mitzrayim, and specifically in the place called Goshen. That's in Perek Mem Hei, Pasuk Yud. V'yashav tav eretz Goshen. You should settle in Goshen, v'yisa karov elai, and you'll be close to me, you, your family. This is Yosef's message to Yaakov. And the question is, what's so special about Goshen? I mean, it's singled out. And interestingly, when Yosef says this is Yosef's message to Yaakov, you'll settle in Goshen, it sounds like Yaakov knows about Goshen, because otherwise, but Yaakov's never been to Mitzrayim. Which means that how does he know there's such a place called Goshen? That they're already talking about it. You're probably wondering where you'll be. The answer is you'll be in Goshen. Well, how is that a known entity to Yaakov? But what's the milah of Goshen? Well, as Mefarshim point out, on a very straightforward level, it's far away from the hustle and bustle, from the metropolis of Egypt. That's not, the Jewish people don't really necessarily want to be too close to all of that. It's a little bit, it's out of the way, which is good. They can be left alone, should they wish to be left alone. That's the milah of Goshen, is that it's off the beaten track a little bit. The truth is, according to Chazal, there is an association that the Jewish people have already with Goshen. The Pirkei Rabbi states that when Avram came down to Mitzrayim with Sarah and Paro took Sarah, so as one of his overtures towards moving towards marriage with her before things went very badly for him, is that he gave her a dowry, and it consisted of the land of Goshen. Eretz Goshen was what was given to Sarah, and from a certain point of view, although things stop there, it remains under the holding of Bnei Yisrael. They have a certain affinity with it. They have a certain connection with it. At the end of the parsha, it says, "Vayeshvuba." They settled there. "Vayeachzuba," and they establish themselves there. But achuza is a holding. It's like an ancestral holding. "Vayeachzuba." They were actually going to a place where they had actually a connection and some form of even ownership of.
Sorry, where was that?
The final pasuk. Final pasuk. But there is a further point which is very fascinating. We see within the parsha that Yaakov has mixed feelings about coming down to Mitzrayim. On the one hand, Yosef, from whom he's been parted for all these years, is alive. However, he doesn't want to leave Eretz Yisrael. And that's what gives us the reaction of Yaakov upon hearing that Yosef is alive is very interesting. He says, "Rav, it's amazing. Yod Yosef ben Yichai, my son Yosef is alive. Elcha ve'erenu b'terem amus. I'll go and see him before I die." Which is seemingly a rather modest plan, given the fact that Yosef is alive. We would have thought Yosef is alive. When can we move? But he's not planning on moving. He will for sure see him. I'd like to go and see him, but he's not planning on staying there because he lives in Eretz Canaan. And there is Chutz Laaretz, specifically Mitzrayim. So with all of his excitement and with all of his indescribable joy, it doesn't lead to more than a plan to go and see Yosef. But as they say in modern Hebrew, Zmani. On a visit on a temporary nature, and as we've mentioned in previous years, in the beginning of Pasuk Mem Vav, as a prelude to going down to Mitzrayim, it says he offers korbanos lelokei aviv Yitzchak, and Rashi comments as do others. Only Yitzchak is mentioned; Avram is not mentioned. And as some Mefarshim point out, what it means is that he's looking through his korbanos, he's looking to connect with Hashem, he's looking for guidance. But what he is expecting is that Hashem will give him the same instructions that he gave Yitzchak, namely, you can't live there. Yitzchak wasn't allowed to go there at all. He's expecting to be related to in a Yitzchak type of way. That is to say, to be restricted from living there. to his surprise, when Hashem does appear to him, and if we take a look actually in Pasuk Perek Mem Vav, Pasuk right, Pasuk Aleph, Vayizvach Zvachim Lelokei Aviv Yitzhak, but what Hashem says in Pasuk Gimel, Al Tira Medor Mitzrayma, do not fear going down to Mitzrayim, and in Pasuk Dalet, Anochi Eredimcha Mitzrayma, Vanochi Alcha Gamalo, I will go down with you, and I'll come up with you. And really what that means is you can't come up until I tell you to come up. And that was a surprise for Yaakov. He's not expecting it. And it's something of a cause of anxiety for Yaakov. He doesn't want to leave Eretz Canaan. It seems he has no choice. However, is there any solution? Is there any even partial solution? If you look at the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, there are two ways to configure the boundaries. There is the land of Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Canaan, as we received it upon coming up from Mitzrayim. And those boundaries are mentioned at length in Parshas Maaseh. But there is a more expanded version, or a more expanded map, of Eretz Canaan, which is referred to much earlier on in the Torah. And that is when Hashem promises the land to Avram in the Bris Ben Abisarim. There, it describes more territories. And that's the Eretz HaMuvtachas, right? That's the land that is promised, ultimately, that it's not going to happen till Yemos HaMashiach. But it is a larger configuration of Eretz Yisrael. Now, the southern border of that depiction of Eretz Yisrael, which is in Perek Tes Vav, Pasuk Yud Ches, Parshas Lech Lecha, is that its southernmost point is called Nehar Mitzrayim, from the river of Mitzrayim. Now, there is some discussion as to which river that refers to. But Mefarshim explain that Goshen, as the Torah refers to it, was a place all the way in the northeast of Mitzrayim. And the point is that that portion of Mitzrayim, from a certain point of view, is yet part of Eretz Yisrael, because it is northeast of Nahar Mitzrayim, and it is yet part of the Eretz HaMuvtachas. And it's fascinating to consider whether this finds expression in the Pasuk. Let's have a look at Pasuk Perek Mem Vav, Pasuk Kaftes. Yosef is about to meet Yaakov. Pasuk Kaftes. Vayesor Yosef Merkavto. Yosef gets his chariot together. Vayal Likras Yisrael Aviv Goshna. And he goes up to meet his father in Goshen. Now, as we know, the term aliyah, in the Torah is used when a person goes from Chutz La'aretz to Eretz Yisrael. Conversely, it's referred to as yirida, yarod yaradnu, redu shama, Yaakov says to the brothers. If Yosef is going from one place in Mitzrayim to another place, that is to say, from the center to Eretz Goshen, why is that called Vaya'al? Why are we using a term that is normally reserved for a person going from Chutz La'aretz to Eretz Yisrael? Says the Radak in his Perush to Yehoshua, Perek Yud Aleph, the reason why the term Vaya'al is used, because this is referring to Eretz Goshen as part of Eretz Yisrael in the more expanded sense. That's exactly why Yosef has placed Yaakov there. He wants to stay in a land that answers to Eretz Yisrael, at least of the broadest description. And accordingly, the trip that Yosef takes to Yaakov is called Aliyah, Vaya'al Likras Yaakov Aviv. It's interesting, as Mefarshim point out, although it's a delicate point, if we have a look at the final pasuk of the parsha, Vayeshev Yisrael be'eretz Mitzrayim be'eretz Goshen. Yisrael settles in the land of Mitzrayim be'eretz Goshen. That's all correct. But what's interesting is the Torah has reversed, if we pay careful attention, the Torah has reversed the way that it refers to the terms. Generally speaking, when the Torah gives us, if there's a city and a country, it will mention the city first, as if to say, in this particular place, in the broader setting of. And as such, it should have said that they settled in Eretz Goshen, the Eretz Mitzrayim. Why does it reverse the terms? But the Mefarshim explain, because from a certain point of view, Eretz Mitzrayim is the most general, and Eretz Goshen is not Eretz Mitzrayim. As if to say, had it said Eretz Goshen, Eretz Mitzrayim, it could only mean the city of Goshen, which is in Eretz Mitzrayim, implying that it is fully part of Eretz Mitzrayim. But the point of this final pasuk is that on the one hand, they settled in Eretz Mitzrayim, but on the other hand, not quite, because they're in Goshen. So this is a very interesting aspect of the way that Yosef provided for Yaakov, interesting insight into Goshen. A further point, it's a pronunciation point, but interesting nonetheless. Within Eretz Goshen, they were in a specific location, in the land of Ramses. There's a few terms moving here, because in Pasuk Yud Aleph of Perek Mem Zayin, but it states again, Perek Mem Zayin Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayoshev Yosef Esachiv Esachav, Vayitein Lehem Achuza Be'eretz Mitzrayim. He gave them a holding in Eretz Mitzrayim, B'meita Ba'aretz Be'eretz Ramses, in the land of Ramses. And Rashi explains that's part of Goshen. So actually, they're in Ramses, which is in Goshen, which is in Mitzrayim. That's the way that it goes. We will meet Ramses again, because Ramses is one of the cities that was built up by the Jewish people when they were enslaved. Like even Ari Miskanos Lefara is Pisom vs Ramses. So if we ask a Balabatish a question, well, if it's not going to be built until the Jewish people build it in Parshas Shemos, how can they settle there in the land of Ramses in Parshas Vayigash? It's possible to say that when it says they built it up. But the simple understanding is that it didn't exist, and they built this new place called Ramses. But the truth is, says Ibn Ezra, if you're careful, as Ibn Ezra beckons us to be, you'll see that these are not the same place. And in fact, they are not even pronounced in exactly the same way. If you look at Pasuk Yud Aleph, it refers to it as Eretz Ramses. Look at the ayin. There's a shava under the ayin. Okay. If you look in the beginning of Shemos, when it talks about the cities that they built, it says Vayiven or Es Piso, the Es Ramses. There's a patach. It might even be a chata patach. There's a patach under the ayin. Ramses and Ramses are not the same thing. They sound similar enough. If you say them quickly, they can begin to sound like each other. But they're two separate places. Not every two places that sound like each other are the same place. Brooklyn sounds like Brookline. They're not the same. And Ramallah sounds like Ramallah. And they're also not the same. So if you're careful, I'm not sure if they correct the Balkorei, if he called it Ramses instead of Ramses and vice versa, but the closer attention we pay, the more we note that these are actually two different places. That's an interesting idea from the Ibn Ezra. Let's conclude this evening by referring to the meeting that took place between Yaakov and Paro. And that is in Pasuk Mem Zayin, Perek Mem Zayin, Pasuk Zayin. Perek Mem Zayin, Pasuk Zayin. Vayoveh Yosef es Yaakov avi, vayomideh lufnei Paro. So Yosef brings his father Yaakov, he stands there before Paro. Vayavarach Yaakov es Paro. Yaakov gives Paro a blessing. Vayomer Paro Yaakov, kamayim esh nechayecha. Paro says to Yaakov, how old are you? Which is quite a forward question. But if you're Paro, I guess you can ask what you want. And Pasuk Tes says, Vayomer Yaakov, Paro, Yemei Shnei Migurai Shloshim Ma'ashana. the years of my sojourning, 130 years. Me'at vera'im hayu yimei shnei chayai. The years of my life have been few, they've been bad. I did not achieve, did not attain that which my fathers attained in their lifetime, which is quite a, I guess if you ask the question, that's the answer, but that's Yaakov's answer. There is a well-known, and we're talking, of course, on the Madregas of the Avos. It's not to be taken lightly, but the Baalei HaTosfos quote a Medrash that Yaakov paid for this. Because Yaakov lived, as we'll be told in next week's Parsha, 147 years. His father lived 180 years. And that was actually meant to be the standard. Avram lived 175. He lost those 5 years that he shouldn't see Esav. But the default, so to speak, is 180 years. And Yaakov also should have 180 years. But if you look at these psukim, says the Medrash is 33 words. And Yaakov complained. And he paid with a year for each word of complaint. That's what the Medrash says. That is it. That's expensive. But that's the level upon which Yaakov is held accountable. Some people, they don't get going until word 34. But this is Yaakov. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz asks an interesting shaila. You see, the 33 words begin with Paro's question. How old are you? And Yaakov is part of it. I mean, he said more than Paro did. But it's not 33 without Paro's question. So why do we configure Paro's question into the words that Yaakov has to pay for? It's what Yaakov answers, so then that could be 20 words or whatever it is. But why should he have to also, why is part of the cheshbon Paro's the words of Paro's question? Which is a good shaila. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz gave a very profound answer. And that is that the only reason, again, it's Yaakov Avinu, but the only reason that Paro asked is because Yaakov looked so old. He looked so weathered. He'd been through so much. He just looked impossibly old. He looked older than he was. And Paro almost couldn't contain himself. And even though it wasn't perhaps the most politically correct thing to say, he just blurted out, "How old are you?" And that's why when Yaakov responded that my years have been few, that means I'm not as old as I look, but this is why I look this way. Well, so why is Yaakov accountable for Paro's question? So Reb Chaim Shmulevitz says because he shouldn't have looked that way. In other words, part of what is demanded of Yaakov is that he should not have let things get to him to the extent that they did, that he looks so weathered, that he looks like he's been through so much, which is quite a thing to say, because he'd been through a lot. But nonetheless, says Reb Chaim, on Yaakov's level, he shouldn't have looked older than he was. With all that's happened, he should have maintained his equilibrium and his connection and his hope and all of those things. And that's why he's held accountable even for Paro's question. The final point, which I think is really food for more thought, I'm opening the question but not closing it, is that, and I hope this is not too much of a Yekesha Shaila, but the words, the 33 words, include not only Yaakov's question, not only Yaakov's answer, and not only Paro's question, but also the Torah's narrative words. In other words, the 33 words are pasuk from pasuk Ches and Tes, beginning with Vayomer Paro al Yaakov. But Vayomer Paro al Yaakov is not Yaakov talking, and it's not even Paro talking. It's the Torah talking. It's just describing what Paro is about to say. So why does Yaakov have to pay for those words also? I mean, that's no one saying anything in the situation. And that is a very interesting shaila. And I think part of what the Medrash is saying is that it's not just a question of quoting the words of Paro and of Yaakov, but rather these are the number of units that the Torah is devoting to this part of that meeting. And it includes the Torah's own narration. It could be that Paro said more than Kamei Meshneyecha. What if he said, "My dear sir," and Yaakov should have stopped him? "Don't call me, don't say anything. Just abbreviate the titles. Everything you say to me is going to be another word." It could be that he's that, but the Torah formats Paro's words into those four words because all of this, as if to say, it expands outwards into the Torah's own narrative. Because these are the psukim that the Torah is devoting to that whole thing, and therefore the Torah chooses the amount of units it uses, because it's 33 words worth of indictment of Yaakov again on his level. And that's how part of the Cheshbon is also the words of the Torah itself. As I said, food for thought, we'll leave it over there for this evening.